This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Today's episode is approved for continuing education credits in the province of Alberta for both life and accident and sickness licensing. It will be valid for Financial Planning Standards Council financial planning credit. It will be approved in Manitoba as well and in all other jurisdictions that have a continuing education requirement. It will be valid. We are also getting these courses approved for Advocus CE credits, so we'll have an Advocus number, an IAS number. Not yet at the stage with IROC CE credits. We will get there eventually, but no IROC credits yet. For a school like ours, IROC credits are actually pretty expensive to apply for and a little bit cumbersome, but we'll get there eventually. Hi, and welcome back to the CE Drive podcast. I'm Jason Watt. We have two guests for this episode talking about behavioral finance. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later on, but behavioral finance is a relatively new topic when we're talking about financial advice and financial planning. We're going to hear from Russ first off, and Russ is going to talk about some applications of behavioral finance in his practice. And this is more of a theoretical type of discussion. He talks a little bit in here about some specific client experiences, but we really cross a fair number of behavioral finance items as we go through this. And he doesn't get into too many specific client details, just touches on them as we talk about this. We'll also hear from Melanie. You heard from Melanie in our very first episode. And in this episode, Melanie's going to talk about a very specific experience she had with a client where there's a hefty behavioral finance element to that. As we listen to both interviews, I do want you to think about a couple of things. I want you to think about what would be going on in the client's mind as you're having these conversations or as the client is explaining themselves, and not necessarily what the client is saying, but what they're actually thinking or feeling while they're having these conversations. I think that's where we can start to find some use of behavioral finance tools. And the second thing to think about is how can you communicate effectively with the client to help further these conversations or to help get to the heart of what the client is actually trying to say or is feeling. It's not always easy for people to elaborate on their emotions, and we have to have a way to be able to pull that out of our clients. So much of behavioral finance is strongly rooted in emotions. The color for today's episode is orange. The color for today's episode is orange. You will need that to get your CE credits. Before we get into Russ's interview, and I really enjoy talking about this stuff with Russ. He's, as you'll hear, a student of behavioral finance. I think to a strong extent, it's actually his learnings of behavioral finance that brought him into this business. I want to give a little background on what behavioral finance is and what it consists of. Historically, we have looked at economics. So economics has traditionally said that people are going to make decisions that will optimize their marginal utility, which basically means that most economics, at least traditionally, assumes that when somebody makes a decision, the reason that they make that decision is because it will put them ahead the furthest financially. Now, anybody who's listening to this call who's watched people make financial decisions knows that that is simply not true, that people are irrational with their money, that we are motivated by fear and greed, that our lizard brain takes over a lot of our financial decision making. And we're not wired for this financial decision making. One of the challenges we have is that this concept of money is actually relatively new in human evolution. And to take that a step further, retirement, which is often our biggest financial limitation, also is a relatively new concept in human behavior. If we were having this discussion 200 or 300 years ago, me at my mid-40s, I would be at the near end of my life expectancy, or even possibly past life expectancy, depending where in the world we might be. So the idea that people would actually live long enough that they had to conserve assets, that they had to defer consumption, is a relatively foreign idea. And I don't know if that's really a behavioral finance idea or if that's more of an evolutionary psychology idea. I don't think it really matters. The point is that we are not necessarily wired to make good decisions with money, especially when it comes to the long term. Now, going back to economics, economics kind of assumed, at least for a couple hundred years, that people made good decisions or made the decision that was in their best interests. Rewind here to 1969. In 1969, two Israeli scientists, Daniel Kahneman, whom you've heard me speak about before on these podcasts, and Amos Tversky, felt that they could actually learn something about decision-making. They actually weren't finance guys. They were psychologists. And they felt that they could learn something here about decision-making by using money. Basically, for them, money was really just a metric to determine how people made decisions. So Kahneman and Tversky say, we want to learn a little bit more about decision-making, and we'll talk a little bit about the science of decision-making at the end of this episode. There's some stuff that I want you to take away here around the science of decision-making. And they say, can we better understand how people perceive risk and how people will manage that risk? And they did a bunch of what we would call A-B testing, meaning that people have option A and option B, and they would do things like build an experiment where somebody would have the chance to gain an amount of money, or somebody would have the chance to gain a smaller amount of money, and then they would do the same experiment, but they would switch out losses for gains. And they did a ton of this kind of experimentation. What they found, and again, this should not be surprising, what they found was people were willing to take a risk to avoid a loss. So people would do anything they could to avoid a loss. We are, by nature, very loss averse. And on the other side of that, when it came to a gain, people would not take a risk. People would take the sure thing prospect, as it were. And this is what we end up calling, this is prospect theory. Prospect theory based on the idea that there is a prospect for a gain and a prospect for a loss, and that people will take extraordinary measures to avoid losses, but will not do much to have the opportunity for larger gains. Now, there are some problems with behavioral finance research, and the first thing that I will point to here is that one of the problems is that we only find it's about 70 to 80% of people who tend to favor that type of behavior, which means you can't assume that every client is going to be so loss averse and risk averse necessarily, that you might see that 20 to 30% that don't fit neatly into that experimental outcome, they might be a little bit more willing to take a risk for a gain, and they might not care too much about a loss. So have to be always a little cautious. The other caveat I would provide here with behavioral finance research is that I find a lot of the outcomes respecting behavioral finance really focus on just kind of naming behaviors. So why does somebody make this bad decision, or why does somebody make that bad decision? And I don't think that's terribly useful in its own right. It can be interesting, and certainly I get the chance to talk to a lot financial planners and financial advisors who are hearing about these concepts for the first time. And I would say almost everybody finds it interesting. But when you start to dig into it, the question becomes, okay, is it useful? And I think to get to the point where it's useful, we have to have a little bit of a deeper understanding and really be able to look at what's driving our clients' decisions, what's causing them to say what they say, and what's lying below the surface. Now, we're going to hear from Russ right away, and you'll hear that Russ is a student of behavioral finance. I wanted to share something here that I experienced with Russ. What had happened is not long after I met him, I had a friend of mine who reached out to me and said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to help with my financial planning. And I knew that this person wasn't really in a position where there was a lot of money on the table. I know this person well enough to kind of understand what was happening here. And it was more a concern about how they interacted with their money than it was about looking for, let's say, some retirement planning or whatever the case is. If this person had been looking for, let's say, retirement planning and investment advice, I probably would have chosen a different person to refer them to, honestly. But when this person reached out to me for advice, I said, okay, let's send them to Russ and see if this sort of matches up. So this is the email that I got after connecting this particular person with Russ. So I asked, did you end up getting in touch with him? And the response was, and this is unsolicited other than me asking if they talked, I did, and we had a meeting last Saturday. He was the perfect person to talk to. He's going to help me with the mechanics of my finances, but he was also sort of a money therapist. And you'll hear him talk about coaching in here a little bit. The message I got from him was, let's make your money work for you to accomplish your goals, which is kind of funny because he talks about staying away from that word goals, but clearly that's something that this person attaches to, which sounds like common sense, but it spun my head around because I've been living my life like, quote, do everything in my power to earn more money and save more money regardless of the sacrifices I need to make. He made me realize that money is a tool to be used, not that I'm a slave to a pile of gold. And that's the end of the testimonial. I thought it was a really strong testimonial, and I think it does speak to the utility of behavioral finance when we look for actual lessons learned and when we try to hear what the client is saying. I would be surprised if there's testimonials that point to that, let's say, depth of understanding of the client that often out of an initial meeting. Now, I'd be curious to follow up on this and see where the relationship ended up. But sometimes you get people who are very enthusiastic initially, I know that, and then that enthusiasm wanes. Again, before we get to Russ's discussion here, I wanted to establish just a few things that we see in behavioral finance. I think this can be useful. There are three sort of core elements to this. There's the concept of heuristics, and then there's framing and biases. What are each of these things? Well, a heuristic is a decision-making tool. When I apply a heuristic, it really means that I've just taken a shortcut to decision-making. Instead of going through a careful analysis, I have applied a heuristic. And these heuristics are useful and necessary, and we probably have to live most of our lives using heuristics. I'll give an example here. This is the example I always use. Some folks that are listening to this have probably heard me say this before. But let's say that I'm on my drive into work. Okay, I get to a light, and this light allows me to turn left against traffic. When it's green, I don't have to wait for the little arrow. I just have to wait for oncoming traffic to be clear. I'll have a decision to make here. Now, what I could do, I could approach that intersection. I say, okay, this is a four-lane road that I'm trying to cross, and I know that lanes in Edmonton are 3.5 meters wide, and then there's a boulevard in the middle, and that boulevard is a further 2 meters wide. That means that this street is a total of 16 meters wide that I'm trying to cross. I know that the optimal amount that I'm supposed to be out in the intersection to make my left-hand turn is 45% of the width of that intersection. Therefore, I need to be 7.6 meters out into the intersection. And from that point, I can make my decision about whether or not to turn left safely. I watch oncoming traffic. I know the speed limit on this road is 60 kilometers per hour, but I also know that Edmonton traffic tends to move at an extra 15% beyond that. So I know that cars will be closing it at 70 kilometers per hour. I know that light standards in Edmonton are spaced 50 meters apart. And with that 50 meter spacing, that oncoming traffic should be crossing a light standard every 2.8 seconds. I can use that then to assess when it's safe to turn. Now, I hope nobody actually does that. Maybe I should have given some sort of trigger warning for those of you that are driving while you're listening to this, but I know that that's a ridiculous way to conduct my drive into work. That is not going to be helpful. It's not going to get me to where I am safely. That's why I need to use heuristics. I need to pull up to the light, say, okay, I know what kind of road I'm on. I'm watching oncoming traffic. Car's about that far away. Time to make that turn. That's really it. If I start to overthink it to the extent that I just described, I will not ever get anywhere. And I would suggest that doesn't apply to driving alone. That applies to many, many decisions that we might make. Now, those heuristics work well in our sort of shorter term or more routine transactions, but when we have more in-depth transactions, this is where we might have to dig in a little bit and make a more robust decision. The problem that people run into then is when they apply a heuristic to a decision like buying a car, and that's when people end up buying more car than they can afford, buying a car because they see something they like rather than thinking about whether they can afford it or not. They maybe didn't walk into the dealership with a plan about what they wanted to buy. So that car buying, not a great place to apply heuristics. Driving the car you bought, good place to apply some heuristics. I'm sure you can appreciate then the extension of this for financial planning purposes, where if we can get somebody to make more conscious decisions and avoid the use of heuristics in their longer term or more impactful decisions, this will be quite useful. The next term I mentioned is framing. Framing, just like it sounds, is what's the sort of frame that I build around a problem that's presented to me? How do I view that problem? And we have to frame problems. This is going to happen. No matter what, everything that presents itself to us, we're going to look at it with our particular framing in mind. Now that's good and that can be useful. It's important though to recognize what the framing is. Do I have maybe an optimistic attitude about something or a pessimistic attitude about something? I think you'll hear from Melanie in the second interview. I think the client she's dealing with had a particularly optimistic view of his ability to earn money and didn't mind taking on debt, even though it probably didn't make sense in the circumstances. And then the last tool that I mentioned here, a bias. A bias means that we have some preconceived notion that might flavor how we make our decision. I know that I carry some biases. I happen to have a bias against investing in residential real estate, and I really try to pay attention to that when I'm in class. When it comes time to talk about investing in residential real estate, I try to give this a fair shake. It's not always easy to be aware of your biases, and probably if I hadn't talked about residential real estate over and over and over again, written sections about it in textbooks, then I probably would not be aware of my bias. I'm sure that I carry many unconscious biases that do influence my decision making. Okay, let's see what Russ has to say then, and after that we'll rejoin and talk about what he has covered. Thanks very much for joining us today, Russ. How are you doing?
Doing great today. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Russ is a fee-only financial planner based in Calgary. And I say financial planner, financial coach, I think is maybe what you prefer.
Yeah, financial coach is kind of the preferred nomenclature for what we're doing. Yeah.
Makes sense. I think we're going to talk about that distinction in a later interview. And you don't carry any licenses at all then, Russ? No investment, no insurance license, nothing at all?
Nope, just based on or fee based, and we don't carry any licenses, just all about the advice.
Perfect. Thanks very much. One of the things that I was struck with when I first met you was the extent to which you've integrated behavioral finance into your practice. I know you're a student of behavioral finance, and I know it's one of those buzzwords that's out there. I find a lot of people who talk about it, but it was interesting to see somebody who's living it a little bit. I'm hoping you can talk to us a little bit about how you have integrated that into your practice.
Yeah, so I've been really interested in the behavioral finance aspects ever since I was introduced to Dr. Daniel Crosby and Richard Thaler's writings. I really feel that the clients that I have come across, they all have one thing in common, and that's they need help with tools to manage their habits. We're in this world where everything tells us to buy, everything really wants to separate ourselves from our money. And my clients in particular, people just starting out, people that don't have a lot of assets, they really just need help on those tools.
Now, I'm curious, Russ, the extent to which anybody takes the position here that, you know, you read this a fair bit in, say, Dan Ariely's writings, that the cards are kind of stacked against us, that we really have to find ways to beat the marketers or beat the credit card issuers or whatever it happens to be. I'm wondering if you run into people who have a perception that's a defeatist way of looking at this. Is that something you've ever encountered?
I definitely see people and come across people that always think that, you know what, it's better to have a positive outlook on the way our economy works. Like, the economy is basically working for us. Everything's growing. And, you know, as you had mentioned before, a tide lifts all boats. But I kind of feel that with the finances and with marketers trying to separate people from their money, we kind of need the other side of just educating people about those decisions around money, how it affects them, what is the long-term impact if they delay in saving, investing, and just not paying attention to where their money goes.
Now, given that you're a student of behavioral finance, is there a particular book that you like to recommend? Do you send your clients away and say, go and read this or watch this set of videos or anything like that? Any sort of go-to?
Right now, I don't try to overwhelm my clients because a lot of it is just them, their beginning of understanding about behavioral finance. So I really try to break it down from them. I try to help them implement those tools. But there's books such as The Laws of Wealth by Dr. Daniel Crosby. And the one book that I'm reading right now is, I believe, Misbehaving by Richard Thaler. And it really talks about the progression of behavioral finance through his eyes and what he has done in the studies. And it's a very easy read. And it's actually really fascinating, the different studies that they did early on to try to understand how people make those decisions. And I've been finding it really fun. So I wouldn't hesitate to give that to one of my clients.
Interesting. I know some people like Your Money or Your Life. I haven't read any Thaler myself. I haven't got around to it, but not surprising given his blog is very readable, and that's a good recommendation. Now, as far as actually talking with a client, what would be some of the things that you would identify in, let's say, an initial meeting with a client where you say, there's a cue there, or there's an indicator that they're subject to this particular bias? What have you maybe seen in actual client engagements?
The main thing that I see in my client engagements with the demographic that I work with is just a lack of understanding about where their money goes. I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a bias one way or another. It's just they feel that it's either too scary to look at their cash flow situation, or they feel that they've tried doing budgets before, cash flow analysis, and it just doesn't stick. So it's not so much biases on my part at this point. Actually, I'm going to break it up here. There's definitely a bias in sunk costs, the sunk cost theory. People are very rarely willing to part with something, even if it's a drag on their finances, such as a vacation property, maybe even a bad investment, something that has been losing money, but they've feel like they've put so much money and effort into this that they're unwilling to let it go. They want to ride it out. They want to see where it goes. They have the belief that it's going to bounce back, but there's really nothing that
nothing to support that. You know, theoretically, long enough time horizon returns are always positive, but that doesn't help out most investors, right? How do you help people to recognize, or what can you do to maybe shake them up a little bit when you see that sunk cost bias at work?
The one thing that I do is really kind of go down a line of questioning with them, let them understand and let them use their own words about where they feel it's going. And then kind of ask a little bit more questions about, okay, well, why do you feel like it's going to go there? What makes you feel like this is going to be the outcome out of all other outcomes? And then really piecing together other questions. Here's a little fact, but how would that play into the outcome? Here's a little more fact. Yeah.
Have you had success with that approach? Do people respond well? Do they come to the right realization?
It's actually very surprising when people really sit down and think about their decisions and think about the outcomes and think about the possibilities, the wheels definitely start turning. It's definitely not an instantaneous, I can't think of the word right now.
Like a realization or reaction?
Yeah, it's not an instant realization that, okay, this is what's going to happen. I need to change things or I need to do something differently. But it definitely is something that they marinate on. And over time, it really helps them add a little bit more clarity. And they're more welcome to have a full-on discussion about, okay, what needs to happen with this certain piece of property or certain investment.
It's a hard bias to shake. It's deeply ingrained often. And I think everybody falls victim to it at some point, sunk cost or an endowment bias or whatever version of that you're dealing with. My favorite example of that is with people in their cars, but I don't know if you see much of that. I hope not.
Yeah, cars are another big thing where people, they think it's a necessity. They love their cars. They have a very strong attachment to their cars. And when we run the numbers on different things, they actually don't realize the amount of expenses and monthly costs that are associated with that car, even if they're not driving it on a significant basis.
Absolutely. It's one of our biggest sunk costs. Now, yep. Circling back to your comments earlier about getting people to have a better realization about where they're spending or managing some of their cash flow, what tools have you had success with on that front?
Some of the tools that we use and we find a little bit more success is using a budget that's based on when paychecks are coming in and when reoccurring bills are going out. So we don't like using a budgeting system where it is a line by line, itemized monthly projection. We feel like it's a bit too rigid for our clients and they need a little bit more flexibility. So what we do is on that monthly reoccurring bills, one of the reoccurring bills is their spending amount. So they get to move $100, $200, $500 into another account, and then they don't have to worry about it. The only thing that makes it top of mind is that they see that account slowly going down over the month as they're spending. And it tends to help them reduce their spending or at least keep it a little bit more top of mind.
That's matching cash flow to your paycheck sounds straight out of Thaler. That's not surprising. Anything else that you can get people to do to maybe rein in their spending? Is there anything else you can think of that's been successful? That's a good starting point or good example of that. I'm curious if you've got a concrete talk to this client and came to this action based on the client seeing this or realizing something.
Yeah. So when we bring up this type of spending, this type of budgeting and looking at their cash flow a little bit more in depth, we really attach it back to the goals that they've come up with and their vision for what the life like. We don't usually use the word goals since with a younger demographic, that seems a little bit too set in stone. We kind of say, what are the options that you want in your life in the future? You want to keep open. So when we do the cash flow analysis and that budgeting based on paycheck, we always attach it back to like, if you're doing this, well, you're going to keep these options open. When they feel like they can't stick to the lofty goals of saving, then it's kind of like, well, these options are going off the table. You still have these options in the future, but the better options, the cottage down in Arizona, those things start disappearing. So when we attach it to those, we definitely see a result.
It is a good thing to do if you can get somebody to recognize what they're, and I like that use of the word options instead of goals. I think you're probably right. Most people, especially younger people, would think about goals as a very abstract concept. Options seems a little bit more tangible.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had clients that have come to me and say, well, we never want to quit working, so retirement's not an option. So it's hard to, you know, attach a goal, savings goal, to be like, okay, you need to save so much for retirement. Instead, it's like, well, would you want to travel? Would you want to do these things? Even with one client that I have had, their big thing is they don't want to quit work, but they do want to live abroad for a couple of years and work from abroad. So I've shifted the retirement focus planning into, hey, here's the option that you really want to enhance your life. Let's base your savings options around this so that, you know, that will always be an option no matter what point in life you guys are at.
Perfect. Do you have any other thoughts around managing or getting clients to manage their own behaviors? Anything that you've seen work or not work, maybe, Russ?
I think the main thing about making sure clients feel safe, secure, and non-judged whenever they come into the office. The younger demographic that we're working with definitely feel that if they are being approached by a financial advisor or have a meeting with a financial advisor, they feel like they're going to be judged based on their lifestyle and the non-traditional sense of, you know, maybe renting and not buying, not having enough savings, still having student debt. So it's mainly making sure that clients feel listened to, heard, and non-judged.
That's great. Thanks for sharing some of your lessons learned from working on the behavioral side of the client relationship. That's great. I think a lot of people will find that valuable. Russ, thanks kindly and have a great day.
Well, thank you very much, Jason.
You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College. bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way.
This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com.
Really great stuff from Russ there. Now we're going to hear from Melanie. And as Melanie shares this story, I do want to think about a couple of things. I want to contemplate how language plays into this. You'll hear me ask Melanie a little bit about language, and specifically the language spoken here. And the other thing that I wanted to think about is, does the method of client discovery impact some of this? That is, if Melanie had met this client by a referral and not on a walk-in basis, might that have changed how this interaction played out? So let's hear what Melanie has to say about this particular client interaction.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us today, Melanie. So we're joined today by Melanie. Melanie's a financial planner here in Edmonton, but she is originally from Quebec. Melanie, you were telling me a little bit before we got started here about an unusual walk-in case that you just encountered, and I think there's some useful lessons here. I'm hoping you can talk through a little bit about where this came from.
Absolutely. So this was a walk-in client that found my name on the Financial Planners Standards Council website. He's originally from West Africa, and he's been in Canada for about 5 years. What he's done in the last little bit is he's taken out some lines of credit, let's say, and he's taken the money out there and then investing in a business that a family member owns in his country. That investment yields or has yielded so far about 12% annually. Now, why I thought this was an interesting case is because heuristics becoming a more and more talked about subject, I guess. These lines of credit that this person was taking out at almost 10%, and this investment really at 12%, I think make him understand that he was not even breaking the point of inflation. So this investment really is only giving him percent once he's paid the compounding interest of the line of credit. He's done that with a couple different banks. And so it's kind of become a tough retirement planning wise, because now this debt is not being paid off. He's paying off the interest. And yes, he's making 12% on that other investment. But at the end of the day, he's paying more interest than he's really making.
And especially when you take taxes into account, because that's still taxable income.
Absolutely. He's not necessarily in a very high tax bracket that you would think that people would make these more risky investments. But I think that that's definitely something that was a harder conversation, let's say, to make understand that he's not making as much money as he thinks.
Did he come and see you because he was going to try and borrow more money, or was there some other motivation for him to come and see you?
No, actually, he came because he was concerned about his debt, and how he said he needed a financial planner and he had a lot of payments. He has about a 50,000 or so income. So when you start counting all these little 25,000 here, 8,000 here, 13,000 there, it counts for a lot of interest and a lot of payments that you have to make everywhere.
And just a lot of mental load that way, not even the financial load there, the mental load is significant, isn't it? That's, I guess, why he...
Absolutely. The stress of having to make all these payments, it's huge, because even if you're only making interest payments on these lines of credit, at the end of the day, this is a lot of money in your budget on a $50,000 income in Alberta, which is it's nothing to spit on, obviously, but it's obviously nothing to write home about.
Although that's what's happening, isn't it?
Yes. It's becoming more and more common, I guess. Yes.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that he's from a country where he would have been taught French in his education system, and you were sort of required to switch to French to deal with him. And I found some of those comments interesting. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, Melanie?
I thought it was really hard to have a French conversation from beginning to end. I was raised in Montreal, which is very bilingual, and I've always worked in this industry, and we've always worked in English. So even though my first language is French, having these conversation and trying to translate all these terms for what is a stock in French, what is fixed income in French, or how do we even say compound interest in French? It was really tough to come up with these terms.
I find that quite instructive, because I think that we take for granted, compound interest is a great example. We take for granted that we know what compound interest is, but the fact that you working in this business had to scramble for the French equivalent for compound interest, we shouldn't take for granted, I think, that clients know these terms.
Absolutely. And I think that deep down, you know, when you think about it and you start having the conversation, eventually you come to a term that you understand. Now, is it the right term? I'm not sure. But I've made up my own terms in French. Well, time will tell, I guess, if anybody else knows what I'm talking about. But I find that I do that in life in general too. Is I kind of make up an English word that kind of sounds like the French word, and most of the time people know what I'm talking about.
Now, with this client, do you think that he's going to follow up on the advice you've given? Will he actually stop borrowing money to finance this business back home? Is this going to yield positive results for him?
I think that what will be positive is that the investments that he does have in Canada, the RSPs, I think that we will work towards building a better portfolio for him. But I think, and this is where heuristics come into play and where it's funny, is that he's got his heart set on helping family business in West Africa. And so that is something that is hard, even though this is a very smart person, he's an engineer, he understands all of this, but this is something that's important to him to help out a business. And to him, everybody kind of lives on credit to some degree. And so I don't think that he's quite ready to cash out that investment in his country, in that family business. So I think that's going to be an ongoing subject that we're going to have to just keep working on.
Do you have any thoughts as to how you might get him to, and, you know, there is some value to this. I you know, if the client thinks something is important, it's important, right? Do you have any thoughts as to maybe how to get him to see the consequences of what he's doing?
I think that the last couple of years haven't been bad investment-wise, right? I think if we see a significant downturn in the markets, I think that might move things around a little bit, because if all of a sudden he's not making only 2%, but he's losing 5% or 10%, I think that that will be an issue, because one of the concerns that he raised is the investments that he had at the bank, one of which was a GIC, another one, he had a TFSA in a daily savings account. And so, and his concern was that he wasn't making any money off of that either. So I think that if he sees a significant downturn in the markets and all investments kind of go down, I think he will see really his cost of investing out there.
It is kind of funny how when the markets are going up, we don't learn good lessons. You kind of need that downturn to learn the right lessons, don't you?
Which is kind of bad, because that's when it costs you money. That's when it costs you money. And then that's when you kind of get mad at your advisor, because you're like, hey, how come there's a downturn all of a sudden? Right? I mean, I would love to promise him that I can make him more than 12% every year, but obviously we all know that that's impossible, right? And even if it was 10%, I can't, not in good conscience, can say that I can beat that 10%.
No, and it's, if you do good, that's not, but it's not anything you did, right?
Right, exactly. It's more of an accident of the market.
Okay, that's an interesting case, Melanie. Thanks very much for sharing some details around this client. I found you on the Financial Planning Standards Council website. I don't know how often that happens.
It's the first time for me, I guess. Yeah. It was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, anything else you wanted to share about that particular client, Melanie? Anything that jumps to mind?
No, not that I can think of.
Perfect. Thanks very kindly then.
Thank you.
Okay, good stuff from Melanie there. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, one of my critiques about behavioral finance topics is that sometimes it's hard to see how this stuff plays out in practice. And I have some examples here that I think might be useful. Now, when we go over this stuff in class, here's what I generally find, that if you've got folks in the room who have a lot of experience, they will generally just kind of nod along and say, yeah, I've seen that, I've seen clients who've had that experience. And I would suggest for the person who has a long time in this industry that they will probably know more about behavioral finance from their dealings with clients than anything that I can teach them in class or what they might read from a textbook. That being said, I certainly have seen some of those industry veterans where they really dig into this stuff and find ways to enhance their dealings with clients. Where I think the bigger likely win is, though, is for people who are newer to the industry. And I think what can happen here is for somebody who's new to the business, that person can sort of replace some years of dealing with clients by having a good understanding of behavioral finance and seeing how this can actually influence client behavior. So if we see more folks coming into the financial services industry well-versed in behavioral finance topics, I believe that's where we're going to get an overall win for the industry that will allow those people to basically seem like they have more experience than they do and to interact with clients in a way that maybe replaces some of the experience that they might otherwise be missing. So some examples of behavioral finance topics that I like to explore. We heard Russ talk about sunk cost. And sunk cost is an effect that happens when you've put some money into something and now you feel like that's an investment into that something. This is sort of throwing good money after bad would be the kind of saying we hear around this. And you see this all the time with people and their used cars. So let's say that I'm driving, and I used to do this myself, I'm driving a beat-up old used car. And in the month of January, that car craps out on me, and I have to go and do some repairs on it. Maybe it costs me $300, and I take a day off of work to do it. So now, in my mind, I have just invested maybe $500 into that car. Now, the car's worthless. It's an old junker of a car, and anybody who's looking to buy it from me knows that they're going to spend a lot of time fixing it. But in my head, I've just increased the value of that car by $500. That's an example of sunk cost. The problem here is that I will now have a hard time parting with that car, and nobody's going to pay me what I think it's worth. It really has to get to the point where my pain is so great that I think it's actually going to cost me more money than what I put into it in order to make a decision to get rid of that car. Another that we see is the endowment effect. And I think endowment effect is actually a pretty easy one to see. This is one that comes up in Kahneman's writings. Dan Ariely does some interesting experiments around endowment effect. The endowment effect comes down to the idea that something that I own has a higher value than a virtually identical thing that somebody else owns. And we see this when people are, let's say, given a concert ticket that they would not buy. And now, even though they wouldn't buy the concert ticket before, now they get somebody who comes to them to try and buy that concert ticket off of them, and that person will actually overvalue that concert ticket. They'll say, now that I own it, it's worth more than it was before I won it. I never would have bought it before, but I sure won't sell it to you for any price below what I perceive to be a fair price for it. We can talk about opportunity costs here. Opportunity costs come about when we have a decision to make. So I have to choose between item A and item B. And opportunity costs can influence my thinking here. Basically, what I want to look at is if I choose B and forego A, what's my lost opportunity there? One that we use a fair bit, actually, in financial planning is mental accounting. And we do this often deliberately. An easy example of this is around emergency funds. When I counsel a client to establish an emergency fund, I'm really using mental accounting, because what I want that client to do now is to have one pool of dollars that is set aside for only one purpose. Mental accounting means that I carve my dollars up into their subject uses, and I can actually value dollars differently depending on those intended uses. I might value my vacation fund less than I value my emergency fund, for example. That's mental accounting at work. Not specifically that there's a behavioral finance term to apply to this, but I like the idea of the future self. And some of you might have seen this TED Talk if you're a fan of TED Talks, you can go check out Hal Hirschfeld. I got to see him present this at a CFP board event a couple of years ago, and he's a psych prof at UCLA. He does this experimentation where he plays with how people perceive their future selves. And basically, we don't actually perceive our future selves as ourselves. We perceive our future selves as a distinct person. And this kind of ties back to what I talked about earlier in the podcast when I talked about our inability to plan effectively for our long-term outcomes. The problem then with that future self idea is, why would I save for retirement? The person I'm saving for isn't Jason today. The person I'm saving for is Jason 30 years from now. And why would Jason today make a sacrifice that's designed to benefit Jason 30 years from now? That's a different person. One of the things that we can do then is we can take steps to help that person better visualize their future self. And in fact, there's some experiments being done around this where you'll take a picture of somebody and then feed it into some software that will artificially age that person, and you show that person the aged picture of themselves, and that can create a more tangible version of that future self, which can go a long way to helping that person to better plan for long-term events, to plan for retirement, or maybe to think about insurance and risk management in a better light. Now, I'd said we would talk a little bit about decision-making, and I mentioned that Kahneman and Tversky set down the path of wanting to better understand decision-making. I find that most people never really do learn decision-making techniques. The exceptions here, I often point to physicians, pilots, serious athletes as being people who actually have studied decision making at some point. And for high performers, it's often their decision making acumen that actually allows themselves to be sort of set apart, as opposed to, let's say, a particular physical attribute. Now, there are many different decision making tools. I would encourage you to start with one that gained a lot of traction in the 70s and 80s. In 1976, actually, a U.S. Air Force aviator by the name of John Boyd introduced a concept that we call the Boyd loop or the OODA loop. OODA is observe, orient, decide, act. And I'm not suggesting that you need to adopt this particular decision-making tool, but I talked earlier about the extent to which we are victims of heuristics, and we will use heuristics to make our decisions unless we apply some better tool. And so the OODA loop gives us one example of such a tool. If you become aware that you are making decisions, and that's one of the keys here, is even to be aware that you're making a decision, but if you become aware that you're making a decision, then you can apply a tool like this. So again, that's observe, orient, decide, act. And the idea is something happens, you look around, you say, okay, what is happening? Orient. Now you work to understand what is happening, what are the relevant factors, what are my available choices? And then you decide, you actually make a conscious decision to act, and finally you act, and then you'll reset that. That's why we call it a loop, because then you'll go back through it again. So you're OODA looping the whole time. And I talked before about using heuristics while driving and the probable necessity of that, but we pick on fighter pilots, for example, where this OODA loop originated. Well, fighter pilots are typically operating at a much faster pace than you're operating at while you're driving your car, and they're able to consciously apply these decision-making tools over and over again. From a financial planner's perspective, you're not necessarily concerned about that fast pace. You probably want to just make sure that to the greatest extent possible, you're removing biases, neutralizing framing, recognizing any sort of heuristics that might be at work, and making proper recommendations that consider a broad range of outcomes. And this is actually something that I think we can do when we engage in good, robust financial planning analysis. And On the financial planning analysis side, if we can sort of duplicate the OODA loop, observe is really what we would call collect information from the client. Orient is where we actually engage in an analysis of that information. And I think one of the things you can practice, if you're not sure that you're actually helping clients to arrive at the best possible decisions, I think one of the things you can practice here is before you make a recommendation to a client, write out three possible things you could recommend. Write out some pros and cons for each. You might even do a little bit of math here. And then choose that proper recommendation on that basis. This can get you used to slowing down a little bit and maybe applying some actual good decision-making technique to dealing with that client. Then, of course, decide and act is where we would provide a recommendation to the client. But I find absent that sort of robust analysis or that good decision-making process, what ends up happening is, as financial advisors and financial planners, we fall into the same trap most people do. We end up making the recommendation that we're comfortable with, making the recommendation we've made before, applying a rule of thumb without really thinking about whether that is what's best for the client. Okay, I hope you found this discussion around behavioral finance useful. As I mentioned at the beginning, I know that sometimes this can get into the weeds a little bit and the payoff can be hard to see. The number for today is 6. The number for today is 6. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College, bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way. Okay, if you would join us next time, we're together again in 2 weeks, and then we're going to talk to Derek and Kelvin about client asset management. Thank you very much for joining us. This podcast was presented by Jason Watt. Production and music were provided by Joseph Tong.